yours, I did yours. One kid got a 0, and one kid got like a 12. So I've done 4 out of the 8, 9 students. So I got 5 left. Well,
that's somehow worse than a 0.
Yeah.
Like, what?
The way things were going for that person, I thought he was going to get into the negatives. Well, you could. You could get into the negatives.
Wait, why did somebody get a 0?
Did they just not submit it?
He didn't submit the paper.
Oh, well, I mean, that's like,
yeah,
that's your fault.
Right. No, I get one kid in here got a 0, didn't submit a paper. One student in another class got a 0, didn't submit a paper. And then one student submitted a paper that had nothing to do with this class. And he did not get his topic approved. So, he got a 0 on that. But, I'm not worried about, well, you're done, so I'm not worried about you, and I'm not worried about yours either. All right, let's see if we can get through this. So, I'm having a wicked brain fart. I think we were talking about Nixon's strategy to do the big operation by trying to sever the Ho Chi Minh Trail by going into Cambodia. And I think we talked about the fact that there would be protests and outbreaks on the campus. Because I do remember talking about Jackson State and Kent State. And then I'm pretty sure we talked about the fact that, in general, the Americans approved the operation in Cambodia, but at the end of the day, the people were just tired of fighting. I think that's what I talked about, right? And then I think I did do a little bit about the nature of the war. And I think the last thing that should be in your notes is notable progress in the countryside.
I have really only course is to strengthen our ARVN and maintain presence in Vietnam. That's what I wrote, but I don't know if that's what you have.
That is also what I have, it's the last part.
So maybe I did this one already? Did I talk about Lam Song?
I don't think so, no.
All right, I see where it is. Go back. So I did that, I did this, I did this, I did this. I did that, I did that. I went back too far. I did that, I did that, I did that, because we did that. So right there.
Yes.
All right, so I didn't talk about this. All right, that's what I thought, but I wasn't sure. All right, so obviously we're talking in 1970s, and the war is beginning to change because the Nixon administration is aiming to change the direction of the war. One of the biggest thing is that MacVie begins rapidly pushing for Vietnamization. Why? Because Nixon keeps sending these withdrawal schedules, and one of the primary objectives now of the military operation command in Vietnam was to basically make sure that troops were pulled out on schedule. Interestingly enough, but not surprisingly, as you pull out more troops, so there's less troops in country, casualties begin to drop significantly. So 1970 only saw, and again, I hate saying this because every single American who lost his life in Vietnam was a tragedy, but there were only 6,081 deaths at the end of 1970 as opposed to the 11,616 at the end of 69. Another big change, the commanders over in country no longer talked about ways to achieve victory. Rather, troops were ordered not to go out into situations that could result in harm. Instead, they stayed closer to the bases. They instead used more ARVN troops to go into the dangerous spots. Another interesting note, and I was going to put a whole bunch of letters that I had stumbled upon in one of my books that were written by guys that were in Vietnam in 1970, 71, 72. And one of the strongest things that you see is that, you know, a GI sends a letter home and he promises his parents, I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm not going to die for this lost cause. I saw that phrase in many of the letters that were in one of the books that I used. But at the same time, stats show that there was a huge spike in military punishable incidents, beginning in an upward trajectory from 70 to 71 to 72 to 73. There was an increase in court-martials. There was an increase in infraggings. There was increased notes of insubordination. Basically, the guys were telling their sergeants and their captains and their lieutenants, no, they weren't going to risk their neck for this war. And one of the most interesting things that I saw were references to what more and more were called search and evade missions. So they'd get a report of where there would be UVC activity. And yeah, they would get on the helicopters, they would go out, but instead of going to where the VC were, they would intentionally go to where they were not. Search and evade. Now, and again, I'm not saying that this was a right decision or this was a wrong decision. But as the conflict began to subside, because American soldiers were going out into the jungle less and the ARVN were going out there more, one of the most bizarre consequences of this shift were more and more reports that were showing that conditions for the peasants in the countryside was actually improving. You know, you probably don't remember, but if we remember going back to when, say, Truman was president or Eisenhower was president, you know, they were telling the French, implement land reform, you know, try to improve the lives of the people. That attitude was maintained by Kennedy as well when he tried telling Diem to, you know, democratize, give people rights, give, you know, people property. But the sad thing is it didn't really start happening until 1970, 71, 72. People were moved out of those protective villages, if you remember me talking about them, and were basically allowed to go back to their home. And when they got back to their own villages, they began trying to drive the VC out themselves because they didn't want wars in their villages. And the last interesting thing that began to occur was that the peasants were more frequently reporting VC activity as opposed to giving cover for the VC. So the nature of the war itself, it reaches a weird flux. But the ARVN also showed that Vietnamization on the battlefield was not as successful as the developments in the country. And the example of this, there's three big operations that occurred. We don't have time to talk about all three, so I'm going to only talk about one. Operation Lam Son, 719. This Lam Son 719 is Vietnamese for the ninth route. This was an operation that was designed by General Abrams, head of MACV. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to design an operation that simultaneously would strike at VC strength and giving the ARVN hopefully an easily obtainable battlefield win. Because if you've ever played sports, and I'm assuming most of you have, how is it when you're on a losing team versus you're on a winning team? You know, when you're on a losing team, it just sucks. You just don't care. So what Abrams wanted to do is, let's see if we can give these guys a win, and maybe that will fire people up. The plan was simple. From Khe-San, that base in the north that we talked about, the ARVN would take Route 9, one of the only major roads in the north, and basically drive across into Laos. Why? Well, they got intelligence that in the village of Tre Phom, which was just 25 miles north of Khe-San, there was a huge enemy supply depot. So the goal was, go to the supply depot that supposedly did not have many troops there, bad guys. You go and you seize it. You collect all the munitions and all the supplies. Hold it for 90 days. And they believe that would disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because Khe-San Phom was a major stopping point along the route that eventually made its way down to Cambodia. This would be the largest ARVN operation of the war. 20,000 soldiers would travel in tanks and APCs, the armored personnel carriers. How did they get there? Well, they would be airlifted into Khe-San. So once they were dropped at Khe-San, all they had to do was basically drive 25 miles. The armored column would receive full air cover and support. And if successful, Abrams believed this would cut the line. Now here's the problem, though. Somehow they missed that in close proximity there were over 25,000 NVA, North Vietnamese regulars. And they were well entrenched. They had made their tunnels, they made their underground fortifications. Plus, they had in their defenses anti-aircraft artillery and guns. And on top of that, 88 tanks. All of this was somehow missed. So, the operation begins. They begin driving north. And then a report comes in of what's actually there. The president of South Vietnam, Nguyen Van Thieu, freaks out. He gets on the wireless and tells the column to stop, because he's afraid that if this force gets destroyed, he may lose his best troops. So, of course, the column listens to Thieu. Well, all the while, Abrams is on the radio screaming at them, "Don't stop! Go, go, go!" But the ARVN commanders don't listen. They listen to the president. So they stop. A column, 20,000 troops, about 100 tanks, dozens of APCs on a road in the middle of a jungle. And that's when the NVA strikes. They come in from the sides in an operation or activity movement similar to what happened at Dien Bien Phu, that base that the French lost, and they begin pounding the ARVN. They blow up the vehicles in the front of the column so they can't go forward. They blow up the vehicles at the back of the column so they can't get out. Then they began systematically taking out the different defensive positions that are quickly thrown up. For 3 weeks, the NVA pounds the column. It gets so bad, U.S. aircraft get called in. But remember the way the North fights. Grab them by the belt. So if the NVA soldier is within arm's reach of the ARVN soldier, and an airstrike comes in to blow up the NVA, what's going to happen to the ARVN guy? Self-Vietnamese soldier. It was overwhelmingly chaotic and catastrophic, to say the least. The only course of action was then to pull out. On March 9th, the ARVN column managed to get around all of the debris, and they would slowly limp back to Khe Sanh. And in the end, they suffered catastrophic casualties. Out of the 20,000 South Vietnamese ARVN soldiers, nearly 7,000 would be killed, and another 10,000 would be wounded. You almost suffered an entire catastrophic loss. On the NVA side, only about 6,000 deaths. They didn't keep track of casualties. Vast destruction, vast devastation. Embarrassing. But when Nixon got the report, I'm sure he just put his hand in his head. Or his head into his hands. Probably did. Ugh. Questions? Well, when reports of the failings of Vietnamization get back to the United States, obviously the outcome is predictable. It gets in the newspapers, it's sensationalized, and then the politicians, the opposition, begin to react. Democrat from South Dakota, George McGovern, he condemns the bombing raids by Nixon, that's part of Operation Menu, as, and I quote, "the most barbaric act committed by any modern state since the death of Adolf Hitler." Head of the DNC, the Democrat National Committee, Lawrence O'Brien, goes on the news and warns that Nixon is actually not trying to get us out of Vietnam, but he's planning an endless war in Indochina. So the politicians begin trying to attack Nixon. Another interesting group that emerged was the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, led by former Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Kerry famously goes before Congress and testifies to war crimes committed by American soldiers. And this group famously, the veterans take their medals that they earned in the war and threw them over the fence at the White House in an act of defiance. Now, FYI, when Kerry ran for president in 2004, his own team, because he was a lieutenant on a Swift boat, one of the patrol boats that went into the rivers, his own team testified that he got himself out of Vietnam by intentionally cutting his arm, making it look like a war wound, to get like a fake Purple Heart. And they also claimed that all his buddies on the boat, they also, because there was a book written, Swift Boat Veterans Against Kerry. And they also said that a lot of the stuff that he talked about was just made up. But what was aired on the television in the 1970s was a lot different than what was aired on the television in 2004. Seeing actual guys in their uniforms who had been there testifying against the war, that was a huge, huge political bomb. And of course, the protests continued. In the spring of 1971, a group called the National Peace Action Committee would actually stage one of the largest demonstrations in the history of demonstrations in Washington, D.C. Close to 900,000 people descended upon the Capitol in protest of the war. So learning the failures of Vietnamization, seeing what's going on in the country, Nixon realized that, okay, he's not going to be able to outmaneuver the opposition to the war. He's not going to be able to basically pound Hanoi to the negotiating table. To make matters worse, between April and July 1971, there would be 17 separate votes in either the House or the Senate aimed at basically reducing the war powers that was given to LBJ in the presidency under the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Congress also demanded that Nixon set a final date for full U.S. withdrawal. Well, Nixon never said that, but instead promised to pull out another 100,000 men, reducing the number down to 180,000 at the end of 71. And he also promised the American people on multiple occasions that the American involvement in Vietnam was coming to an end. Questions? Why was he confident? Well, even though Vietnamization is kind of stumbling, even though the protesters are protesting, in the grand scheme of things, at the same time, Nixon and Kissinger are actually making significant diplomatic moves to attempt to triangulate an end to the support for Hanoi. In late April, China expresses its willingness to welcome a visit from either Nixon or some special envoy. An official American diplomat had not been in China since the rise of Communist China in 1949. So, China, who had been a big supporter of Hanoi is now looking like, well, they want to be friends, become friends with America. At the same time, the U.S. and the Soviet Union are also working on trying to come up with an agreement to deal with the problem of intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles. And then at the same time, Kissinger signals to Hanoi through diplomatic channels that the U.S. would be willing to set a date to withdraw if the NVA would just let Saigon stand. But Hanoi did not bite. But pressure was clearly on Hanoi, because at the end of the summer of 1971, Kissinger, to the surprise of the nation, returned from China and declared that he made an arrangement for Nixon himself to travel to Beijing in 1972. This so-called journey for peace, as he proclaimed, was essentially meant to blur the old Cold War lines. You know, the us versus them. And FYI, granted, this took place, I was alive, but you weren't. But if you notice the interesting dynamic that we have today, technically both Russia and China are our enemies, but we do business with them. And it all goes back to this period in time. This was a huge move from the Trumans, the Eisenhowers, the Kennedys, the Johnsons, those cold warriors, the us versus them. Now it's, let's see if we can negotiate outcomes. Let's see if maybe we can work towards disarmament. Let's see if we can maybe do business with one another. So this would allow Nixon to reinforce to the nation that, look, he doesn't want to be a war leader, but rather he wants to be a statesman. That he wants to cooperate with the other powers on Earth to try to make a world for peace. Again, a journey for peace. Not just for our generation, but for future generations on this earth that we share together. Questions? Well, part of the motivation for Nixon doing this is he was worried about the 1972 election. Every 4 years, like clockwork, if there's an incumbent president and he's only done one term, he has the ability to run for re-election. And obviously, Nixon wanted to win. But Nixon was concerned. He won office in 1968 by a slim margin because he promised to end the war. But in 1972, there is no end in sight. To make matters worse, his popular approval level dropped below 50%. It was hovering around 46, 47%. He was actually afraid that he would not win. But he got saved. He got saved by the opposition. To make an analogy, if I may. If the Democrats actually had a primary and they ran somebody that was an actual strong, viable candidate, in all likelihood, Trump would not have won. But what did they decide to do? They didn't want to do a primary because Biden was running for re-election, and Biden proved himself to be a bumbling buffoon. And then when Biden dropped out, it was decided that Kamala would run. And Kamala was not fit to serve as president, which was clearly exposed. So the only reason why we ended up with Trump was because the Democrats screwed up. Coincidentally, same thing happened in 72. The Democrats screwed up. Boom! Three Democrats would emerge. The one that Nixon and Kissinger feared the most, a mainstream moderate candidate, Senator Ed Muskie, out of the gates initially appeared like he was going to be successful. But Muskie, who was from Florida, lost the primary in his own state. So when he lost his own state, he dropped out of the race. Now here's the thing. I'll make an analogy. Muskie was a mainstream moderate candidate. Someone like Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania. If Kamala would have picked him to be vice president, she might have had a chance. Because ultimately, that's what Americans want. They don't want extremists on either side. They generally want centrists. But Muskie was gone. Whew. Nixon dodged a bullet. Leading the charge was, ironically, that Southern Dixiecrat, Governor George Wallace of Alabama. Now, Wallace in 68 ran as a segregationist. But by 72, he announced he no longer was a segregationist. That he decided to become moderate on racial issues. That people of different skin tones are okay in his book. Well, it was Wallace who easily won in Florida and was leading in the polls. But at a campaign stop, a guy by the name of Arthur Bremer would pull out a gun and would shoot Wallace four times. He didn't die, but he was left paralyzed. And he would withdraw from the campaign. Now, Wallace, as a reform segregationist, could have done well in conservative circles. But now he's out. So who's left? Well, the Bernie Sanders of the 1972 race. Senator George McGovern. Leading anti-war figure. Because there was nobody else, he received the nomination at the DNC. But he would run an awful campaign. Again, analogous to what Kamala did. He had the support of the women. He had the support of the African Americans. He had the support of the progressives. But he lost the unions. He lost the blue-collar workers. And he lost, overall, the working class. So as a result, Nixon didn't just win. Nixon won in one of the most landslided elections in the 20th century. Not only did he receive nearly 61% of the popular vote, but he literally carried 49 of the 50 states. He ended up getting 520 out of 538 electoral votes, losing only Massachusetts and the District of Columbia. It was this win that would result in the end of the war. Nixon would use his election win to push for peace. one month before the election, Kissinger would go back to Paris and he would once again attempt to privately meet with the representation of, or representatives of Hanoi. And over the span of a couple of weeks, for the first time, they made progress. They actually managed to break through on five major points, which both sides agreed to. And by the way, this would be the foundation upon which the outcome of the war would be based. One, both sides would agree to an immediate ceasefire. Point number one, ceasefire. Point number two, U.S. withdrawal, but the North Vietnamese soldiers could stay. USA out, NVA stays. Three, there would be a full return of all POWs. All prisoners of war on both sides would be returned. Four, U.S. could supply ARVN. North Vietnam could continue to supply the VC. And last but not least, they would create a council to figure out how to have those elections, which was supposed to occur way back in 1956. So I'll repeat those. Ceasefire. U.S. out, NVA can stay. All POWs returned. U.S. can supply the ARVN. North Vietnam can supply the VC. And they would create a council to figure out how to have elections. Do I need to repeat any of them? Well, here's the thing. It's not just a two-party negotiation, because Saigon's also involved. And when Saigon gets a copy of this agreement leaked to them, they refuse to accept it. And they actually demanded 23 more changes, including all NVA out and no elections. So the U.S. and Hanoi finally had a breakthrough, and Saigon threatens to derail it. Now here's the thing. Nixon could have gone public and used the bully pulpit and went on TV and castigated President Thieu. But he decides to wait until after the election. So he kept this quiet, and because doing so, it probably added votes, which added to the landslide. But the moment the election was over, Nixon went on the warpath, proverbially and literally. First, he contacts Thieu directly. He tells Thieu he should agree to this. But he does promise that if Hanoi goes against the agreement, then the United States would quickly retaliate. But Nixon doesn't make Thieu flinch. And instead, he actually sent more demands. Including a demand that the NVA don't attempt to cross the DMZ, the demilitarized zone. Potentially adding things that Hanoi would never agree to. Because if Hanoi doesn't agree and the negotiations stall, then the war will continue and the United States will continue to prop up Saigon. And ironically, that's exactly what happened. When Kissinger gave to Lê Duc Tho, who's the North Vietnamese primary negotiator, all of the changes that Saigon wants, they reject it. Talks actually broke down completely. And Nixon was outraged. He would go so far to actually threaten to coup Theo, and he ordered the Joint Chiefs to draft plans on bombing Hanoi directly. Nixon was so mad that the talks broke down, he was prepared to go to war with both North and South Vietnam. That's out of order. So, reaching an impasse, Nixon's only option was to bomb Hanoi back to the negotiating table. Beginning on December 18th, Nixon would launch what is known as Operation Linebacker 2. This is sometimes referred to as the Christmas bombing. From December 18th until December 29th, there would be over 729 sorties, airstrikes, against Hanoi, the city, and Haiphong, the harbor. In those days, over 20,000 tons of ordnance were dropped. Midway through, Nixon reaches out to Hanoi and says, look, we'll stop the bombing if we can go back to where we were on October 5th. Nixon also warns Tho that he is going to sign the agreement whether South Vietnam wants it or not. Well, lo and behold, on December 29th, Nixon hears back from Hanoi and they're ready to talk. And when that occurred, the bombing stopped at 11:59 p.m. on December 29th. From December 30th until January 27th, 1973, the diplomats would hammer out an end to the war in Vietnam, which would be signed on January 27th. The basic terms of those 5 points that I wanted you to write down from October 5th. This would end up being a four-party agreement. The United States, the Republic of Vietnam, Saigon, the Provisional Revolutionary Government of South Vietnam, the VC, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, Hanoi. The major terms of this agreement: the United States would publicly respect the Geneva Accords of 1954. Which, if you remember, 1954, one of the biggest things besides elections to decide whether or not North and South would democratically reunite was that no nation was allowed to have an alliance with either the North or the South. The North pledged that if enough people voted for it, that they would leave South Vietnam alone, that they would be able to decide their fate. And if the South voted to join with the North, then reunification would be done slowly. Baby step by baby step, which was all outlined in the Geneva Accords. When this was signed, Nixon went on the tube and he informed the nation.
Go, college internets. Go, college internets.
Favorite kind that I can skip.
Good evening. I have asked for this radio and television time tonight for the purpose of announcing that we today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. The following statement is being issued at this moment in Washington and Hanoi. At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. The agreement will be formally signed by the parties participating in the Paris Conference on Vietnam on January 27, 1973 at the International Conference Center in Paris. The ceasefire will take effect at 2400 Greenwich Mean Time, January 27, 1973. The United States and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam express the hope that this agreement will ensure stable peace in Vietnam and contribute to the preservation of lasting peace in Indochina and Southeast Asia. That concludes the formal statement. Throughout the years of negotiations, we have insisted on peace with honor. In my addresses to the nation, from this room of January 25th and May 8th, I set forth the goals that we considered essential for peace with honor. In the settlement that has now been agreed to, all the conditions that I laid down then have been met. A ceasefire, internationally supervised, will begin at 7 p.m. this Saturday, January 27, Washington time. Within 60 days from this Saturday, all Americans held prisoners of war throughout Indochina will be released. There will be the fullest possible accounting for all of those who are missing in action. During the same 60-day period, all American forces will be withdrawn from South Vietnam. The people of South Vietnam have been guaranteed the right to determine their own future without outside interference. By joint agreement, the full text of the agreement and the protocols to carry it out will be issued tomorrow. Throughout these negotiations, we have been in the closest consultation with President Chu and other representatives of the Republic of Vietnam. This settlement meets the goals and has the full support of President Chu and the government of the Republic of Vietnam, as well as that of our other allies who are affected. The United States will continue to recognize the government of the Republic of Vietnam as the sole legitimate government of South Vietnam. We shall continue to aid South Vietnam within the terms of the agreement, and we shall support efforts by the people of South Vietnam to settle their problems peacefully among themselves. We must recognize that ending the war is only the first step toward building the peace. All parties must now see to it that this is a peace that lasts, and also a peace that heals. And a peace that not only ends the war in Southeast Asia, but contributes to the prospects of peace in the whole world. This will mean that the terms of the agreement must be scrupulously adhered to. We shall do everything the agreement requires of us, and we shall expect the other parties to do everything it requires of them. We shall also expect other interested nations to help ensure that the agreement is carried out and peace is maintained. As this long and very difficult war ends, I would like to address a few special words to each of those who have been parties in the conflict. First, to the people and government of South Vietnam. By your courage, by your sacrifice, you have won the precious right to determine your own future. And you have developed the strength to defend that right. We look forward to working with you in the future, friends in peace, as we have been allies in war. To the leaders of North Vietnam, as we have ended the war through negotiations, let us now build a peace of reconciliation. For our part, we are prepared to make a major effort to help achieve that goal. But just as reciprocity was needed to end the war, so too will it be needed to build and strengthen the peace. To the other major powers that have been involved, even indirectly, now is the time for mutual restraint, so that the peace we have achieved can last. And finally, to all of you who are listening, the American people, your steadfastness in supporting our insistence on peace with honor has made peace with honor possible. I know that you would not have wanted that peace jeopardized. With our secret negotiations at the sensitive stage they were in during this recent period, for me to have discussed publicly our efforts to secure peace would not only have violated our understanding with North Vietnam, it would have seriously harmed and possibly destroyed the chances for peace. Therefore, I know that you now can understand why, during these past several weeks, I have not made any public statements about those efforts. The important thing was not to talk about peace, but to get peace, and to get the right kind of peace. This we have done. Now that we have achieved an honorable agreement, let us be proud that America did not settle for a peace that would have betrayed our allies, that would have abandoned our prisoners of war, or that would have ended the war for us, but would have continued the war for the 50 million people of Indochina. Let us be proud of the 2.5 million young Americans who served in Vietnam, who served with honor and distinction in one of the most selfless enterprises in the history of nations. And let us be proud of those who sacrificed, who gave their lives, so that the people of South Vietnam might live in freedom, and so that the world might live in peace.
Unfortunately, despite President Nixon's optimism, things didn't quite work out the way that he intended. On March 29th, as was required under the terms of the agreement, the last American combat units would be pulled out of Vietnam. On that day, technically speaking, the most controversial war in American history would come to an end. But just because the war for us ended didn't mean the war actually stopped. In fact, over the next 2 years, both North Vietnam and South Vietnam repeatedly violated the terms of the agreement. They engaged in strikes and operations and so forth. But in the end, South Vietnam's fate was sealed. Nixon did try continuing economic aid, but all economic aid to South Vietnam ended when Nixon was impeached in 1974. Because when he was impeached after the Watergate scandal, Nixon resigned. When he resigned, the Democrats, who controlled Congress, immediately passed a law called the War Powers Act, which stripped the president of the ability to basically do whatever it takes, whenever he wants. So in the end, President Ford tried, but when the Democrats cut off funding, South Vietnam was left alone. And as a result, on April 30th, 1975, NVA tanks would roll into Saigon and the South Vietnamese government would surrender unconditionally. No vote was taken, but in the end, reunification of Vietnam was officially declared on July 2nd, 1976. Instead of the two divided countries was the government that exists today, the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. Saigon would be renamed Ho Chi Minh City in honor of the father of that country. And when that occurred, Vietnam's 30-year struggle for independence, actually even longer than that, would come to an end. Questions? So let's end where we began, because if you recall, we began at the end. Well, combat operations and combat troops were pulled out on March 29, 1973. American personnel would remain in Vietnam all the way up until April 30th, 1975. The same day, the North invaded the city. The final move was to get out all U.S. personnel. The final official operation of the Vietnam was Operation Frequent Wind. That was an 18-hour operation in which 1,373 Americans and 5,595 Vietnamese would be extracted in 81 helicopter runs. Now, I did mention back when I showed it the first time, this is actually not the last chopper. Even though this was put in the newspaper to symbolize, look, the copter's full. He actually has a gun pointing at the guy at the ladder because he's going to hop on the helicopter and it's going to fly away. This was actually the evacuation of CIA headquarters. And this was taken the day before. The last official chopper was the CH-46 Sea Knight, and it evac'd the Marine Service Guards from the U.S. Embassy. And that occurred 7:53 a.m. on April 30th. The last American to leave was Major Sergeant John J. Valendez. This guy. Now, what can we say about Vietnam? Well, to date, it was the fourth most costly war in United States history. From 61 to 75, this doesn't even include all the pre-war stuff, the United States would spend $141 billion, which with inflation puts it close to a trillion. During the so-called Vietnam era, and if you're ever at a store and you see an old guy that has a hat that says Vietnam era soldier, that just meant you had to be active from the beginning of the war to the end. That doesn't necessarily mean they were in country. But during that time period, over 9 million men and women were on active duty serving our country. Of which, as Nixon mentioned, 2.7 million had actually served in Vietnam. $58,220 soldiers, however, lost their lives, which was roughly 1.7% of the people who served in country. The youngest man to die was Dan Bullock. He was 15 years old from Brooklyn, New York. He died on June 7th, 1969. How did he get in? Well, he wanted to serve his country. So he actually forged his birth certificate to make it look like he was 18. The oldest to die was Petty Officer First Class Kenna Taylor. He was in the United States Navy. He actually died of a heart attack. Now, FYI, 61% of the soldiers who died were under the age of 21, which are all of you. There were actually five who were 16 or younger. There were 12 who were only 17 years old who died. There were 32 sets of brothers who were killed in action, and three sets of father and son. There also were eight military women who died, as well as 59 civilian women who died, including Lieutenant Pamela Donovan of Alston, Massachusetts. She got ill. She died of disease at the age of 26 years old. There are also 17,215 men who were married. So that meant there were 17,215 widows from Vietnam. And lastly, there were 153,372 wounded in action. Oh, one last stat. As of today, there are still 1,584 men who are missing in action. Now, like all wars, there is a first combat death, and there is a last combat death. But just because their faces are going to come up on the screen, that doesn't mean they're any different than the 58,218 men that are sandwiched in between. The first official combat death was Army Specialist James Thomas Tom Davis of Livingston, Texas. He was killed near Duc Nau in South Vietnam on December 22, 1961. He was one of the advisors to an ARVN unit. The last combat death was Army Colonel William Nodal of Menominee, Michigan. He was killed in Anlock. He was 43 years old during an artillery firefight. His death was just 11 hours before the agreed ceasefire. But sadly, Colonel Nodal was not the actual last death. The last deaths in Vietnam were two Marines. Marine Corporal Charles McMahon, 22 years old, of Woburn, Massachusetts, and Darwin Lee Judge, 19 years old, of Marshalltown, Iowa. Both were killed at the airport in Saigon on April 29th, when a North Vietnamese missile came in and struck the base. Bless you.
Thank you.
Like all wars, there were also recognition of meritorious service. And in Vietnam, there would be over 234 medals of honor, which is the highest honor that any soldier can get. And lastly, Nixon was going against the Poles. Nixon was going against the hippies and the anti-war protesters. Nixon was going against group like Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Nixon was going against Democrat politicians. But what about the people? That silent majority that Nixon talked about. Well, truth be told, it depends on when you ask. After the Gulf of Tonkin incident, in August of 1965, 61% answered a Gallup poll asking whether our involvement in Vietnam was a mistake. 61% said no, 24% said yes, 15% said they had no opinion. But by war's end, it completely flip-flopped. 60% said yes, our involvement in Vietnam was a mistake, where only 29% said no. But what about the men who actually were in country? At my post, we have 5 Vietnam vets. My father was a Vietnam vet. And I've asked him a simple question. Was it a mistake? Well, in a poll that was sent out to veterans through the VA in 2015, 97% of the soldiers who actually served in Vietnam in both combat and non-combat roles, 97% were honorably discharged. So that meant only 3% did something like fragging their commander or insubordination. So most served with honor and distinction. And of those, 91% said they were proud to have served in Vietnam. They were proud of their service. They were proud of being there side by side with their buddies. And even most telling, or more telling, was 74% of the veterans said if they had to do it again, they would do it again, even knowing the outcome. Keep that in mind if you ever see newsreels of how the hippies treated the veterans when they came back from Vietnam. There never were any parades that heralded the end of, like, World War II or the Korean War. Soldiers were tormented, called baby killers. They were spat on. They were often embarrassed to have any type of insignia showing they were military. Which is interesting when you walk around any store today. You see people with all types of military symbols on their shirts. Attitudes have changed. But at the end, you couldn't stop the inevitable. The North Vietnamese, that nationalist movement, began by Ho Chi Minh, could only be stopped when it achieved victory. And like the war, even great things like classes must come to an end. Questions? Tuesday, 10:30. That's when you're having your final. Okay? In person, paper exam.